Welcome to the Daily Bulwark Podcast, the pre-holiday edition. A quick reminder, you can subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, or, well, just anyway, iTunes, any place where they have podcasts. And today's podcast is brought to you again by Pod by 8 Sleep. We'll have more information about that. We're joined today by Mark Salter, who's a longtime speechwriter and confidant of the late John McCain. And really good to talk with you on the eve of, what is it, the Trump of July. July 4th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good to talk to you, too.
You know, I was trying to think of things I could ask you that you probably haven't been asked before, but I'm undoubtedly going to fail at that, because my first question I have to ask you is, what would John McCain be thinking about Donald Trump's takeover of Washington, D.C.'s July 4th celebration?
Well, I'm sure it would have bothered him. I usually try to avoid those kind of suppositions for him, but now that he's not here, but it would have bothered him when Trump had been talking longer than a year ago now, I think, about some kind of giant military parade. I know that concerned John. He would have expressed it sarcastically, probably humorously, his opposition to the idea, and made fun of it, but which is why he was such good company and why we miss him so much. But it would have that kind of grandiosity self-pleasing grandiosity bothered him a great deal, I thought.
Yeah, we have a great piece up by Tim Miller up on the website today, and he talks about, you know, that the president is planning, so basically, to the hashtag International Chocolate Day version of July 4th. It's all phony branding, no history. It's this gaudy, narcissistic Trump extravaganza. And, you know, I was on a show yesterday, and there was some heavy breathing about how scary and frightening this was, and you know, references to North Korea and Russia. And I thought that was a little bit overblown, because I think the real point of all of this is just the tacky narcissism of
That's
it.
Right.
You know, the insecurities displayed by the president who never served himself, and also this whole notion that somehow everything has to be about Donald Trump, that everything must center on him. And what frustrates me about this, I don't know, July 4th has actually always been one of my favorite holidays. I mean, it is one of the holidays where we were all Americans, where it wasn't politicized. I mean, it was certainly not militarized, but it was not politicized. It was like we would all say, hey, we actually have a shared narrative, we have a shared story, we have the shared flags. And now, of course, it's the era of Trump, and so something that was supposed to bring us together is dividing us. How
That's
Trumpian.
Right. Yeah, I'm not worried that, you know, what school children are going to be forced to join May Day parades every year now or anything like that. It's just
right,
Trump
right.
being the through line for Trump is always is whatever he does, whatever he puts his hand to it, you can rely on it to be as classless as imaginable, just as tacky and self-centered and just full of himself. There is.
Well, and the bottom line here is, and Tim makes this point, is that July 4th is really the celebration of the American idea. And Donald Trump has no idea what the American idea really is, right?
He has none. There isn't a value that matters to him, obviously, in the conduct of his foreign policy and his sycophancy towards, you know, a murderer's row of some of the greatest thugs in the world. The United States has fought in wars to safeguard our interests and advance our values. And because people get killed in those wars, well, that's the same as Vladimir Putin poisoning a journalist. You know, what's the difference to him? Nothing matters to him because he doesn't have any values of his own. You would like to think that there are personal qualities that our political values are rooted in: kindness, empathy, consideration, recognizing that you have no more dignity than somebody else. Trump has none of that. You're right.
Well, no, and I guess we're at the point now where it's sort of like same old, same old. You know, I mean, Thomas Jefferson, you know, thought the Independence Day marked the restoration of the free right to the unbounded exercise of reason and freedom of opinion. And
yeah.
Donald Trump just got back, you know, from going around the country, you know, making cracks about, you know, basically bragging to you know, Vladimir Putin, how he cracks down on journalists expressing their opinions, you know, and he pumped up this despot. I mean, it's just, it is sad, but I do hope one of my concerns is that in our era of, and this has now become a cliche of tribalism, you go on social media and there are the folks on the left who actually do have a certain disdain for the American founding, who think that we shouldn't display the Betsy Ross flag because somehow it is a symbol of oppression and slavery, and that this country is, you know, it was, you know, founded in this original sin, etc. You know, ignoring the, what I think Matt Lewis called the promissory note of the Declaration of Independence. But I'm just hoping that Americans take a deep breath and go, you don't have to choose between that left-wing disdain for the flag and Donald Trump, that there is a broad, rational middle here.
Yes, right, where most people live, and which, you know, too often, obviously, you feel both parties these days don't really want to represent anymore, for whatever reason, I don't know. But I think it gets tedious, to be honest with you, Charlie. After a while, you know, people ask, obviously when he takes another shot at McCain, I get calls from reporters all the time. And, you know, the last few times, well, how does that make you feel? Well, it's not about how I feel. But to be honest with you, it's just gotten tedious. It's just boring now. You know, John had a healthy dose of self-respect, so Trump never really, you know, Trump's attacks or insults of him never really bothered him all that much. And they don't, to be honest with you, bother me all that much because he is so clearly a better man than Donald Trump that I, you know, no one should have any insecurities about that. But it just gets, after a while, it's just tedious. This perpetual adolescent who's stuck in this. This is the kind of way you behaved in sixth and seventh grade in junior high. And really by high school, you were starting to shed some of these, you know, intensely self-centered qualities that Trump just can't. He's just a tight golf ball of insecurities, and he can never leave anything to go. And it just becomes, even this stuff, even the parade. I mean, I'm up in I live in a little town on the coast of Maine, and it's very Norman Rockwell here on the 4th, and it makes you feel great. We have a little parade with kids, you know, kid-centered parade, and they have tug of war contests and pie eating contests, and I'm just, you know, I'm just going to spend tomorrow not looking at Twitter and not watching cable news and not paying the least bit of attention to Donald Trump's self-glorification at the Lincoln Memorial, you know, standing next to the antithesis of a president, the memorial to the antithesis of a Trump president, Abraham Lincoln. But it's offensive, but I'm not going to let it get to me because I don't know.
You would think that Donald Trump would avoid comparisons with Abraham Lincoln, but apparently he lacks.
If I were Trump, I try to avoid comparisons with Buchanan. I mean, it's like there isn't one of the other 44 whom he doesn't come off poorly. But
apparently there are advantages to not only being shameless but also being completely historically ignorant. So I know. Okay, I agree with you. The incredible tediousness of Donald Trump's obsession and the fact that he is a case of arrested development, but it does raise the question about why Donald Trump is so obsessed with John McCain. Why everybody else in the world wants to move on from this, except Donald Trump is stuck on this. And from the moment he basically said he preferred people who didn't get captured, to every opportunity he has to bring it up. What is the, and I know you've thought about this, and I know you've talked about it, I know you've been asked a million times about it, so this will be a million and one. You know, what is Donald Trump's obsession about John McCain? What does it say about him?
You know, I once answered that question in an interview by saying, I don't know, I'm not a child psychiatrist, but my assumption is, my armchair psychological assumption is, that somewhere down in that thick crust of braggadocio and selfishness, there's a fair amount of self-loathing. He knows that in comparison to John McCain, the real Trump is apparent. He's the opposite of all those things. McCain had a sense of honor, had a sense of integrity. McCain's statesmanship was always focused on really on human rights, on, you know, on recognizing the dignity in everybody, even our enemy. All the qualities you'd want in a human being, not just a politician, obviously. You know, he sacrificed. He believed in sacrifice. He believed in sacrificing for a cause other than himself. all the things Trump is the antithesis of. Somewhere there's some kernel of self-awareness in the guy that knows it, and he reacts the way he reacts because McCain's memory is a even though he's deceased, it's a living rebuke to Donald Trump, and Trump knows it.
I think that's exactly right. I think there is that kernel there that, and I'm not a psychologist, I'm a child psychologist, I don't even play one on podcasts, but there is that sense that Donald Trump at some level knows that John McCain was the man that he could never be. And that comparison always rankled with him. I mean, look at the July 4th. He wants to surround himself with all the trappings of military might and military service, and yet he was the guy that never actually served. Okay, so I want to move on because I don't want to let Donald Trump ruin the entire July 4th holiday. I want to talk about, are you paying attention at all to what the Democrats are doing?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, well, I want to talk about that. Let's take a break for our sponsor, and then I want to talk with Mark Salter about what the Democrats are doing and one of the great mysteries of American politics that I'm hoping that he can solve for me. We'll be right back. Let's talk about sleep. Listen to these studies from Harvard and Johns Hopkins. Chronic sleep deprivation has been shown to lead to depression, diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease because, frankly, we all need 8 hours of sleep, right? Right? You know that. You know how cranky you are if you don't get it. You know how lousy your day is if you don't get 8 hours of sleep. But one of sleep's biggest problems, it's temperature. It's tough to get good sleep if you're too hot or too cold. So I want to tell you about the Pod by 8 Sleep. The Pod by 8 Sleep is a high-tech bed designed specifically to help you achieve optimal sleep fitness. It was developed by leading sleep researchers after tracking 43 million hours of sleep. And here's how it works. It combines dynamic temperature regulation and sleep tracking to enhance your rest and recovery. It learns your personal sleep habits and adjusts the temperature automatically. That means if you like the bed cool, like I do, and if your partner likes the bed warm, well, now you can have both at the same time in a crazy comfortable bed. Sleep longer and deeper so you wake up refreshed and ready to take on the world. So to celebrate Independence Day this year, get a free gravity cooling blanket plus free shipping with your Pod purchase. That's a $300 value free. The offer ends next Monday, July 8th. Just visit 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's 8sleep.com/bulwark. We're back with Mark Salter. You know, I'm watching Donald Trump and the Shambolic administration, and I have to tell you, and you're a veteran of politics, I actually think that he is better positioned for re-election than I would certainly like to hope, or that a lot of observers do, because next year's election is not going to be a referendum. It's going to be a binary choice. And I'm not sure that the Democrats right now are running to win that election as much as they are running to show their ideological purity. So give me your take on what you've seen so far.
Yeah, that concerns me. Obviously every nominating contest is focused on your own party voters, and that's, you know, which we've been in plenty of, right, going back to McCain's 2008 election when he was the nominee. You know, there was a lot of coverage saying, "Oh, is he running too far to the right to win this nomination? Is that going to hurt him in the general?" And the same as it does seem to me, and it's probably because I think it's a vital U.S. interest that Donald Trump be defeated. And to that extent, I won't vote for a third party candidate. I'll vote for whoever the Democrats put up, the candidate who's going to be either Democratic nominee or Donald Trump. It's not going to be somebody else. I may be philosophically at odds with the Democrat. Almost certainly will be. But I just think it's that important to get Trump out of office that I will. Having said that, I feel a lot better about it if it were, you know, Joe Biden or Amy Klobuchar or Pete Buttigieg or somebody who somewhere recognizes that, you know, that there are voters out there that live in precincts outside of West Hollywood and Berkeley and Brooklyn. We'll see. I mean, there's always that concern that they're going too far. And there is a lot of, you know, for instance, you know, Kamala Harris's embrace of Medicare for All, her abandonment of Medicare for All, her re-embrace of it, and her abandonment again. It's just, you can just, you know, I've sat around a lot of campaign ad makers before, and yeah, I can just see the ads that are going to be made off this, and they're going to be tough, you know.
That's a, by the way, that's a great point, because everybody's talking about, the media is talking about, you know, what a powerful performance she had at that debate. And in fact, she made a major gaffe.
And she did.
By flip-flopping on the question of whether Medicare for All meant the abolition of private health insurance.
Right.
And I'm not sure they're doing the Democrats any favor by ignoring it, because you are absolutely right. The ad makers are already, doing the storyboards of them all yeah. raising their hands for health insurance for illegal immigrants and her back and forth. But clearly this race is down to, and you tell me whether you disagree, because you've seen candidates come from behind in these primaries. It certainly looks like they have their big four: Biden, Sanders, Warren, and Harris. I'm looking at this ABC Washington Post poll that came out today, and the number of candidates who are at a stone-cold 0% is extraordinary. Eric Swalwell, John Delaney, Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, Seth Moulton, Steve Bullock, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Tim Ryan, absolutely zero. Julian Castro, Cory Booker, Michael Bennett, Hickenlooper, Inslee, below half of 1%. It's hard for me to imagine. And Beto O'Rourke, by the way, is at 1%, which means that he is tied with Tulsi Gabbard and Marianne Williamson.
Yeah, I know. There are too many of them, obviously, but I don't think any of them are going to get out, and they're going to look at the last debate. Harris, who was obviously polling a little bit better than that going into the last debate, but nevertheless, she had her moment, and now she's gotten, a pretty substantial boost out of it, and they'll all think, well, I can have that moment. Castro probably thought he had that moment. He kneecapped Beto O'Rourke, but I'm not sure it turns into much more than that for him, but we'll see what will happen. Not particularly surprising to me, but probably surprising to all the people that, every cycle seem to think, these campaigns are going to be entirely reinvented, how these things do. Iowa, New Hampshire is going to call the herd, whatever's left by then. I mean, the only problem these days is it's just so easy to raise money online that people can go, it used to be you didn't place in the top three in Iowa or one or two in New Hampshire or something, you couldn't raise a dollar, and that was it. You couldn't, you couldn't buy gas for your bus. But now I guess people can stay around and try to position themselves as national celebrities of some one kind or another and prepare for the next election.
That's about the only reason why some of these people are in the race. I can't even imagine why they would get into it. Now, I said I wasn't going to ask any more McCain questions, but I actually started thinking about this in the context of Kamala Harris. Everyone always says they don't like attack politics. They don't like negative politics. But the reality is it works. And, she goes after Joe Biden and everybody swoons at a pretty harsh attack. But we're in this age now where, if you wanted to say that there's almost a Rorschach test about how we feel about politics, it goes back to that iconic moment during John McCain's campaign against Barack Obama, where the woman stands up and says, I don't like Obama because he's this terrible Muslim and everything. And McCain says, no, he's not. He's a good man. He's a good family man. And he pushes back on the attack. And the Rorschach test is the people look at that and say, that was a great moment of American civility and decency versus the new more Trumpian hashtag, it's all about winning. The view of that, which is, that's why he lost, because he wouldn't go for the jugular. And you wonder whether or not we're in this stage of politics, whether there's any room for that kind of grace, that kind of civility, or whether both sides now are demanding this smash mouth, win at all costs, scorched earth approach to running.
Well, I think the bases are, I shouldn't say the base, the fringes or the extremes of both parties obviously want to do that. But if you remember at the time that occurred, it wasn't, I think people were impressed by it. I think the media was impressed by it. But everything leading up to it was McCain is running a kind of campaign in which, people are making racist attacks against him. We weren't. We were doing everything we could right. not to. That was just him. I was trying to explain this. Reporters are standing in the back of the venue, whatever it is, or something, and they're hearing some knucklehead yell something inappropriate at a rally with, 10,000 people at it. The candidate who's up on the stage doesn't hear that. Often his staff don't hear it. We were seeing these stories, so we were aware there was some inappropriate stuff going on. And we made him aware of it, but he had never heard anything. When he had before, when somebody had introduced him and stressed Obama's middle name over and over again, McCain had upbraided the guy and said, knock it off, in a sense. And a couple of other times he had done it when he had heard something. That particular event was, it was a town hall, and he was standing right in front of the woman as she did it. And later on, somebody else did it. And he sort of repeated, you don't have anything to fear about Barack Obama. But that was just McCain being a decent, not just that he came from a military background. He came up in a time of politics, and when he was still in the Navy and the Senate, the Navy's liaison to the Senate, in which, you know, party distinctions weren't quite as, all consuming as they are now. You know, he always talked about he decided he wanted to run for political office when he was, you know, sitting in a markup on the defense bill as the Navy's lobbyist to the Senate, and watching members, Republican, Democrats, scribbling on just scraps of paper amendments that would shift defense priorities and billions of dollars in this direction or that direction. And he thought it was a way that he could impact the security of this country even more directly than he could in the military. And he was a guy that got into politics because he liked problem solving, and problem solving isn't or shouldn't be a terribly partisan. Everybody comes with their own principles and policy points of view, and you want to get 60% or 55% or something. But the important thing is to make progress on the problem. And that's what I think John always understood, that a little progress on our problem, just muddling along, is a magnificent achievement in a country as free as this, you know, with as many vociferous, independent people in it. There just used to be more guys like that. I think there are plenty of people in politics who believe that. It's just we spend a lot of time pandering to the more extreme elements in both parties, because they've got a lot more ways to make their voices amplified, whether it's television or radio or the internet.
Yeah, one more point here. I mean, the decency and civility in that moment that we were describing doesn't mean that John McCain was in any way a milquetoast. I mean, he wasn't. I hope you don't misunderstand this. I mean, he was a cranky SOB at times, wasn't he?
He was Bob Timberg, who was a great reporter and sadly passed away a couple of years ago, wrote a wonderful book called The Nightingale Song. And it was about five graduates of the Naval Academy, one of whom was John. He was talking about John's plebe summer when he was participating in these boxing smokers. And he had this wonderful line about John, and I've always remembered it so that I can repeat it verbatim. But it was, unschooled as a boxer, McCain's style was to charge to the center of the ring and throw punches until somebody went down. And that really was how he engaged in debate. But he was also always looking to advance the ball in some direction. Immigration is a perfect example of that. You know, the comprehensive bills that he and Kennedy and John Kyle and Lindsey Graham and others worked on, they would have addressed the problem, not in a way that made any one side particularly overjoyed, but there would have been practical solutions to a problem that shouldn't be. Immigration shouldn't be harder than Medicare.
No.
You know, it isn't. For all the attention it gets, it isn't the biggest problem facing this country or the most intractable problem. There is a solution out there, a comprehensive solution. And it starts, frankly, with recognizing reality that no matter how much Stephen Miller and Donald Trump want to rid this country of people that came here illegally, there are about 12 million of them, and about 11,900,000 of them are never going to leave. That's just a fact. So pretending that we can come up with some solution to unlawful immigration that rids the country of the 12 million or so that are here without permission, that's, I think, just a waste of time.
Well, it was also just a perfect illustration of what's happened with our politics, because I remember that very, very well. And that carefully crafted bipartisan compromise was really an example of statesmanship. But it was, and I'm going to now simplify, but it was undone by one word. And I remember a speech that he gave on the floor of the Senate dealing with this, because the one word was amnesty.
Yeah.
That whatever you do was amnesty. And amnesty has now been replaced by the wall. It becomes the bumper sticker that you can't have a compromise because it's amnesty. And the solution to this problem, which is complicated but it is doable, is to build this wall, which is not only the dumbing down of American politics, but really what happened to that whole culture of compromise and statesmanship.
Right. It's you know, I was there were three attempts at this, and all of them had broad support. I mean, the last one died simply because John Boehner didn't want to rile up the Tea Party caucus again, and you know, didn't bring it up. But it passed with 67 votes in the Senate, I think.
Which is amazing in retrospect.
Yeah. The wall's not going to solve a problem. So what we have now is de facto amnesty. And people living sort of sub rosa. You know, most people I know, you know, have occasion to employ someone here without papers. But
sure. This morning I was looking at it was the front page of the New York Times, which has these new pictures now about the conditions at the border, the children being held in these squalid conditions, and for the first time we have pictures. And in America today, if it's not on television or you don't see it, it doesn't really exist. And that's the change. And so I was tempted in my mind to say, this is going to make a difference because now we actually can see the squalid conditions. Plus, we have a report from within the administration itself, from within the inspector general. But then the other voice I had was, don't be naive. Really, nothing does matter. It's not going to change it's not going to change Trump's mind. It's not going to change the debate. We are just locked into positions now.
Right. And that's it. I mean, we've convinced the public that immigration is this huge problem, that it's, you know, it's a terrible, that nobody, any naturalized American citizen or native born American citizen doesn't have a job because some immigrant took it. We've exaggerated the problem beyond what it is. And then we offered the dumbest, simplest solution possible. Well, if I just build a wall with spikes on it or whatever, you know, it'll stop all this and everybody will get their job. And then he can't get the wall. So it's just ridiculous. That's
where we are
today.
Long-time listeners of this podcast know that I'm obsessed with the question I'm going to ask you next. The mystery that I'm hoping you can shed a little bit of light on if you want to. What the hell happened to Sarah Palin? Let me tell you exactly what the background of why I'm asking that question and where I think you might have personally come into this question. That right before the Wisconsin primary in 2016, when she was running around the country being a surrogate for Trump, she came to Wisconsin and she spoke at Serb Hall on Milwaukee's south side and gave what was universally regarded as one of the worst political speeches anyone had ever heard. It was just freaking awful. It was so bad that I went home and my wife and I sat in the kitchen and I pulled up our laptop and I said, I want to watch the speech, her acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention back in 2008, and try to figure out, how did she go from this to this? Is this the same person? And I don't know, did you write that speech back in 2008?
No, that was Matt Scully.
Matt Scully.
Yeah, one of the great writers in the Republican Party, really.
And the proof that you can make anybody sound really, really good. So do you have an operative theory of the Sarah Palin of 2008, who I thought, you know, was not ready for prime time, but performed reasonably well, versus what has happened to her?
No, but I can talk. Okay. I can, you know,
that's all we do.
Ruminate. She has political skills, retail skills that are you're born with. They're very, very difficult to be taught. You know, she's the best. For instance, the small little things that you know. She's probably the best rope line worker I've seen, other than Bill Clinton, and all the campaigns I've observed. She's always late finishing them up because everybody gets a word, and she's very empathetic and instinctive about it, and pretty impressive. She's also a convention speech in St. Paul. You know, her teleprompter went down, and you could have never told. So she's very good at delivering, which is a real skill. I mean, it's not to be dismissed. Her appeal to I think John and the campaign was that she had come up as a reformer. She wasn't probably ready for. Well, no one ever is quite ready for how intense a presidential campaign is, but and we probably asked too much of her. You know, she did her best, I think. She appealed to the campaign because she had come up as this reformer who had taken on the establishment and taken on the oil companies and you know, we were looking for some.
No, it looked good on paper at the time.
Change message that Obama owned. What happened to her? It's hard to say. I mean, she left the governorship. I think that was a mistake. There was, I think, a path for her to follow where she could have been a national politician if that were her preference for years to come, which was to probably fill out the portfolio where she was deficient, foreign affairs, national security. She tried to absorb a lot of information on those issues in a short amount of time while doing about 20 things a day, 20 other things a day. But, you know, join the Council on Foreign Relations, travel overseas, start, you know, building up that kind of portfolio, have an accomplished governorship, maybe run again. You know, it's a small state. Population-wise, obviously, but nevertheless, you know, those are the kind of states where you can, you know, you can literally meet every one of your voters.
I just wonder whether she was just broken by the controversy, the attacks, there's something there, because I remember I agree with you. I mean, I remember I was a MC of an event in Wisconsin, where she had spoken, I think it was Wisconsin Right to Life, and she filled this huge auditorium. This was a couple of years after that. And I thought, you know, if she gets in the Republican primary race, she's just going to roll through. I mean, she would just absolutely roll through. And she performed very, very well. And then you had this collapse where whatever was going on. Okay, I don't want to dwell on her, but I keep thinking about that. And because it's so spectacular, and it's one of those moments where I'll be honest with you, I have to say, okay, you know, I know that with the rise of Trump, that I missed a lot of things. There were a lot of things that I should have seen that were right in front of my face that I chose to ignore. This was certainly one of them in some ways. When people argue that you wouldn't have had Trump if you had not had Palin sort of, you know, preparing the way, I get that. But I think it is a mystery.
She acquired overnight national celebrity, international celebrity, and she acquired overnight instant full-on national criticism, scrutiny. It's white hot. It's intense. It can be very upsetting if you're not used to it a little. I think she liked the celebrity, but didn't like the scrutiny that came along with it, and somehow that's old.
You do not get to choose. Marshall, thank you so much for spending time with
pleasure.
Us today, and I hope you have a great July 4th holiday. I hope you have a great Trump-free July 4th holiday.
I intend to. You too, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We're going to take tomorrow off, and we will be back on Friday and do this all over again.